This is The Sound Test, a podcast all about video game music in all of its forms, from its earliest days all the way up to today. This is yet another official interview episode of the podcast, in which I'm more than happy to welcome legendary Jesper Kidd onto the show to talk at length about his work on the Hitman series, as well as some new vinyl releases that are just about to hit the shelves of Hitman. We also talk a fair bit about the Sega Mega Drive / Genesis and his work on a particular Batman game on there that I couldn't help myself from asking about. This is a fantastic interview, one I'm more than happy to bring out of the blue, because if you are a long-time Soundtest listener, you may have been expecting an interview with Mark TDK Knight next. This one came completely out of nowhere, was done really quickly, I was able to get it together really quickly, and I'm so pleased to be able to bring it to you. But do keep your ears out, because the next interview will be with Mark TDK Knight. For now though, let's hear from Jesper all about Hitman and Batman. Hey Jesper, welcome onto the Sound Test. How are you doing?
I've been doing great, man. Thanks. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. I've been really looking forward to getting into the Hitman series and these new vinyl releases that are upcoming at the moment. But I thought that before we got into any of that, like the main subject of today's conversation, that we could spend a little bit of time talking about your early work, particularly on the Sega Mega Drive, or as it's known around the rest of the world, the Sega Genesis, because I am a huge fan of the FM chip that they've got in that system. And I was hoping that we could talk a little bit about your process of writing for that chip, because it's really not easy. It's kind of like an arcane art to make the most out of FM synthesis.
So in order to talk about my Sega Genesis, Sega Mega Drive music, I would need to go back a little further to where I got my start in music, which was the European demo scene. And on the Commodore 64, I got involved with the demo scene when I was 13, I got introduced to the demo scene when I was 13 through a program called Sound Monitor, which I later figured out was actually Chris Schulzbeck music program he had released in a German computer magazine that you had to type in. And so that was like an early version of these kind of tracker programs where things are scrolling down as you are making music. It's like making music vertically instead of like horizontally, which is how we make music now in Cubase. Everything is horizontal. But the early music programs were vertical. And after making hundreds of tracks with the Commodore 64, we call that SIP music or chiptune, which is still alive today. It's amazing. But that was invented on a Commodore 64. And so after starting music on that, I really liked the tracker format. And then the Amiga came along and it really it perfected the tracker. There was programs like Sound Tracker and Pro Tracker, which I also started using. On the Commodore 64, you had a chip inside that was an analog synthesizer, so you could make some really interesting music with the Commodore 64, where things suddenly could have emotion. And so on the Amiga, they removed that and put in four sample channels instead. So very different music style, but still the tracker format remained the same. It's like, a music sequence that scrolls down. Everything is done vertically. And so for the Sega Genesis, we made our own music program that, supported the six FM channels of the Sega Mega Drive. And so we made a tracker for the Sega Mega Drive that also scrolled down. So it's very similar way for me to work. And this was how this is how I like to work. This is how I wanted to work. And this is the music program. This was the design of the music program. And in that music program, you could also make your own instruments, with the FM generator. So I would, make my own instruments for that and compose the music in a tracker. And Yeah, it was interesting because, of course, nobody else had our music program. That was something we had completely custom made from scratch. And it was very different from Sega's music program, which was more popular with samples. But it was like these 8-bit samples that sounded really noisy. And so, of course, our program had no samples. We never got around to implementing samples in our music program. That's something we were actually working on the 32X when Sega gave up on the 32X and we moved on to the Sega Saturn instead. So we never were able to complete that that feature. Nevertheless, I used 6 channels in FM in 44 hertz, beautiful CD quality. And it's very different from the kind of quality that you would get out of Sega's music program.
But it's a much loved sound chip, actually, by quite a lot of people. I mean, even Rob Hubbard himself has spoke very highly of the Mega Drive Genesis chip. And I actually got quite a nice, real retro feeling off your soundtrack, in particular for Batman and Robin, actually, because it's got this amazing opening track that's like over 9 minutes long, which really reminded me of those long, like 12, 15 minute tracks that Rob Hubbard and Ben Daglish used to do.
Absolutely. I mean, that is totally a homage to that generation. And because let's face it, that didn't happen on the Amiga. You didn't have those 9 minute title tune tracks. You can argue that the big games on the Amiga were better, but arguably, at least my opinion is, the music on the Commodore 64 was better than the Amiga, because you had all these amazing melodies. All you had when you had a Commodore 64 and a SID chip was melody, because everything else sounded so crappy. You know, drums, everything was really limited. And on the Amiga, you could just sample. So you didn't even have to work very hard to get a beautiful sound. You could just go sample something and already it's like, whoa, production quality is here already. So yeah, you had to work your ass off on the Commodore 64, and all you really had to hook people was great melodies. A lot of wonderful melodies was written on the Commodore 64. And it's great to hear that Rob Hubbard is a fan of the Mega Drive chip. I also think it's a phenomenal chip.
Yeah, he was doing like these incredible guitar sounds and things like that for games like Road Rash. But the way I lead this into Hitman is to talk about the evolution that kind of everything really changed when the PlayStation happened and we started to get CD audio on console games. I mean, it was already kind of happening on the PC, and you'd have already been doing a few soundtracks like this. But come Hitman 1, you've got this main title that's just full of like real, it sounds to me, real hardware synths and just full percussion, full beats, sequencing. Everything changed. So you've really taken that step out of chiptune and into, I guess a lot of composers say they could do what they wanted at that point, as long as they had access to an orchestra or something like that. So could you talk about how that felt for you as a transition?
Yeah, I mean, I always was making music on the side as I was making Commodore 64 and Amiga music. So what I mean by that is I was making real music with synthesizers. So I had a Roland D20 that I had, saved and worked, you know, to get. And thank God my parents pitched in. And so as soon as I got that keyboard, it had a sequencer built in. And I just started making all these tracks, sequencing all these tracks on that keyboard. So obviously that's what I call real music, you know, there's the or CD-based music, as you called it. So that's something I've been working on the sidelines of my computer music, of my chip music. Because I always was interested in music, and I always knew, you know, you see the history of these game consoles, right? And where it started with like an Atari, and things were like beep beep, and the PCs were like beep beep, and then suddenly the Commodore 64 comes along and it can sing. And you just knew it was going to keep getting better, right? That's just the way things go. And I knew at some point we would be making CD music for video games. And I didn't want to be limited in my knowledge of video game music to Commodore 64 or Amiga. And then suddenly if somebody asked you, hey, can you do, you know, music that's going to stream over CD? And suddenly it's like, no, I can't. I can only do Commodore 64 music or Amiga music. I wanted to be able to keep doing what I'm doing. So I knew I had to keep working on it. And I always had an interest in making music outside of computers as well. So when Hitman 1 came along, it was interesting because I had just finished working on the Sega Saturn with that internal music program that Sega had released. And it was a very, I don't want to say frustrating, I want to say difficult program to work with, because it's not designed to be creative. You know, these are not like programs we're using today where the DAW and the Cubase is just so musical and decide to push your creativity in wonderful directions. This was like the opposite of that. So I was quite pleased that we were done there, because it was a difficult scorcher is the game I worked on with the same guys who did Subterranean and Red Zone. We were called Syrinx. That was our game company, which we formed right outside of, we finished our work in the demo scene and started a game company, or a time in the demo scene, you know. But anyway, so Hitman came along, and IO Interactive was formed by those same guys from Syrinx. And so they gave me a lot of creative freedom. We worked on a lot of music and a lot of games already. And for Hitman, I finally thought, you know, I'm free from the limitations of all these all this music written to the chip, right? For the Genesis and for the Saturn. But lo and behold, we're going to use a music system called Direct Music, which is probably even more difficult to work with than what I had to work with on Sega Saturn, because that literally looked like a database program. So I kind of, you know, knew there's just no way. So what I did is I created all the music outside of that program and, did my best to fit all that music, which was written with synthesizers and drum machines and all this stuff, and did my best to make that music fit into the Direct Music system. And so that's how that was created. And that's why Hitman 1 has this really, it has a unique sound to it, because it's played through that program.
Yeah, this is actually what I was going to say. I mean, obviously we're going to come to some of the orchestral elements that you've included in the series soon, but I was particularly gripped by how much it really sounded like nice, thick hardware synths on that first Hitman. And it sounded almost like, at least in that main title theme, that you were approaching those synths almost orchestrally, like it was big blankets of hardware synths almost acting like strings and brass.
Yeah, it's definitely written from a melodic point of view, which was also something I was really ready for, because the game I had just finished, Scorcher, was like all rave music and dance music, and so was Batman and Robin, you know. And I had been going through doing all this dance music for video games. Not dance music per se, but it still had something that made it fit the games. It wasn't just a blank. It wasn't just a dance track and that was licensed and put on a game. It still sounded like music that worked in the game, but it was very inspired by rave culture, you know. And that's definitely a huge part of my early work. And it's something that I can that I can turn up or down or bring in any time I want now as well. It's not like I forgot how to do it, you know. And even on one of my latest score, Darktide, the Warhammer game, there's definitely rave culture, you know, built into that music style as well. But yeah, I mean, I definitely was going in that direction with Hitman, in the direction of making it cinematic and making it melodic, and was really enjoying that.
Yeah, I loved seeing, I watched like a 40-45 minute documentary on YouTube about yourself in the studio space, and I really loved seeing like how full up it was with modular synthesis and like real proper hardware synths and everything. So you already had a solid collection of that stuff by Hitman 1, I assume?
Yeah, I had a pretty good collection. Some of the vintage analog stuff I was using at that time was the OBXA from Oberheim and the Juno 60 from Roland, the Merriam MSR-2, which was also, that was Tom Oberheim's new company at the time. And what else did I use? I think the JD990. You can argue, I mean, that's probably more like a digital Roland, but still a cool synth. An FS1R from Yamaha, arguably the best FM synth ever made, even though it's just this little rack. Yeah, I was still embracing FM at the time as well, of course.
Yeah, I've got some real synth geeks in my listenership, so I know I had to ask about that a little bit. But obviously things took a big change for Hitman 2, or at least like really dug in to the choir and the orchestra. And I know that that took a lot of study for you, actually, or at least according to some of the other interviews that I've took a look at. So could you talk a little bit about the process of having to step up to working with the Hungarian choir and the orchestra as well?
Yeah, so I hadn't done any orchestral music at that point. That was, I had just finished, I was working on a game for BioWare at the time called MDK2. And Albert Olsen was doing orchestral music and I was doing all the electronic music and synthesizers and beats and all that kind of stuff. So it was an interesting collaboration, and it was definitely something, orchestral music, it's something that I had never dabbled with before. I wasn't, you know, listening to classical music even at the time. You know, of course, like everybody else, I liked the Star Wars music and stuff like this, you know, but I was so far away from that world when I was asked to do a purely orchestral soundtrack for Hitman 2. It just kind of blew my mind that they asked me to do that, because clearly I have no experience whatsoever. So I just approached it like everything else. You know, I'm self-taught. So for me, a big part of who I am and a big part of what my music is, you know, this self-taught thing is, you know, you seek out things that you find interesting and then you teach yourself how to do that. And on the Commodore 64 and Amiga, those music programs didn't have manuals. You know, you had to figure everything out yourself, and it was not straight up, you know, it was complicated. So that's something that I just always have embraced, teaching myself how to do things. I don't usually read manuals. I just kind of figure out how to do things. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of us do it that way. But anyway, it's not something, it's not a place of frustration for me. It's something I find very interesting, figuring something out on my own, you know, without people telling me how it's supposed to be used. I don't like that. You know, I want to use it. I want to find ways not to use it. You're not supposed to do that. Well, that's exactly what I'm going to do then. You know, because you get something different out of that keyboard or that synthesizer when you do things that way. And I can say real quick, you know, there's a lot of emulations of analog synthesizers, but they're, from my perspective, they're emulated in the way that you're supposed to use these instruments. But I don't use all these vintage synthesizers the way people used it back then. I find, you know, you got to find ways to do things. You know, like one of my favorite synthesizers, the CS80, is known for its beauty. But when you overdrive that signal inside the CS80, oh my God, it has one of the most beautiful overdrives, you know, distortions, which you would never think of when you think of a CS80, because it's supposed to be the epitome of beauty. So, you know, the simulations can't hit those things. They can only do things the way you're supposed to. Or they can make the presets inside these synthesizers sound very much the same as the synths. You know, you can barely hear the difference. But when you start tweaking the knobs and doing, you know, things, that's where the difference is huge. Yeah. So anyway, I was not that intimidated by having to teach myself how to write orchestral music. It was just one of those things, like everything else. Okay, I don't know how to do this either. You know, like when you're on a Commodore 64, you don't know how to use that music program. You're just going to do it. So that's what I did. I just studied and listened. The way I studied is I just listened to a ton of orchestral music and just listen. And start picking up, what do I like about this orchestral music? What is it that resonates with me when I hear this or that or this or that? And then once you start figuring out, oh, I like that. Oh, I like this. Then, you know, in your head, a music style starts to form, because you when you are self-taught, you only seek out the music, or you only seek out what you find interesting, and then you teach yourself that. So I don't care about the history of jazz music, for example. If I'm to write a jazz score, then I will care, and then I will seek out that information. But right now, I don't have that information, you know? So I was seeking out this information on orchestral music just by listening to it. And that's what I did. That's how I taught it. Taught myself how to do orchestral music and write for choir and these things.
And to be clear, because I didn't name them properly, it's the Budapest Symphony Orchestra and the Hungarian Radio Choir in Hitman 2, who have also gone on to be used throughout the series as well. So your experience with them must have been quite good then.
Oh, yeah. It was wonderful. As I was there in that glorious symphony hall and they performed the first piece, I just, my jaw just dropped. I was introduced to a whole new music style. Of course, I had been writing the music and I, you know, was enjoying that. But when you hear it performed live, there's something very extra that happens. And I suddenly found myself completely into this music style and into the whole symphonic music, you know, world, and decided at that point that this is something that I was going to have to do a lot more of, because I'm really enjoying this. And it kind of blew my mind, because I'd always been like, oh, electronic music is in my head much better than any other music style. It's the ultimate thing. You know, orchestral music is an old thing that we've heard before, and these instruments are not new. But all that stuff, all those criticisms just kind of disappeared when you hear the magic of what an orchestra actually does. You know, there's something truly magical there. It's like finding the perfect vintage synthesizer and you're like, there's magic in here. You know, that's what it felt like. So it just really opened my mind.
Absolutely. And there's actually a lot of different worldwide locations in Hitman 2 and really throughout the series as well. So I wondered how much that's played into your composition. I guess this is specific to Hitman 2, but also kind of the whole series as well. How much you do listen to different cultural music from around the world to affect that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, Hitman 2 is definitely a world traveler type of game, and so and Hitman Blood Money is takes place in the US, but all these different areas of the US, you know, with different influences. So there was definitely something that that I kept in mind. And I think coming out of the demo scene, you know, I wrote music in a lot of different styles, because there was no reason not to, you know what I mean? I was just exploring what music composition was at that time. So I had already done, you know, music that influenced like Russian music scales, or you know, Asian, Chinese, all these different areas of music, Indian music. I had already been exploring that without fear in the demo scene, right? And so I feel like all that is a good toolbox to have, especially on Hitman 2, when writing all that music. It's you know, not to be intimidated or afraid to go there. You know, if I was to write an entire score based on, you know, Indian culture, I would, you know, probably spend, who knows, you know, a long time researching it. But it's for Hitman 2, I you know, I had a lot of all those influences in the music, and it, you know, there's like one level in India, I believe. So it's, you know, you don't have to spend a month researching. It's, you know, it's more important to get the sound of Hitman out and then have some, you know, some influences from different worlds. Yeah, so that was my focus.
Okay, so and how much of the actual musical direction of each game is coming from the briefs and is coming from the developers, and how much of it is from yourself? Because when we come to Hitman 3, it does turn back into being, I know you've described it as being very, very dark, and electronic music comes back to the forefront. So is that more on the developers or your side?
No, I would say it's mostly on my side. I mean, in these today, I think what I did back then would be called a music director as well, because I was also in charge of finding the music style, you know, and I was also implementing the music. So Martin Polis was programming all the music into the game, but I was telling him very clearly how all the music should work and when it should play and not play and why and all that kind of stuff. And that was a huge part of my my job, in a sense that I would get a new build from the game, then I would play that, you know, that, you know, let's say we work on one level at a time, I would play that whole level through and take a ton of notes and send it to him, and, you know, then he would do the changes. I would play it a whole level through again and then send him more notes, and then until we were at a place where that level felt really good musically, and then we would do all 12, 15 levels like that. It was really, really cool to be so closely involved with the implementation. You know, very much a music director role, because the only thing I was ever told from the studio was for Hitman, that I can recall, was Hitman 2. And then when they said we needed to be an orchestra and a choir, and the main title music should be a Requiem. That was my brief on that project. And then everything else, I went out and, you know, had to figure out. And it made a ton of sense that all the different locations were supported by the music, so I'm sure that's something that came from the studio as well. But that's something we talked about, and it just made it made total sense. For contracts, of course the brief was this is a dark game. You know, but other than that, I really wanted to embrace the electronic side, because I felt like on Hitman 1, I didn't really get to the electronic music depth that I could now achieve, you know, because of the direct music system and all this stuff. There was limitations in play. And so for Hitman Contracts, I was really, really happy to go back and provide a purely electronic score for Hitman after having provided a purely symphonic score for Hitman 2. And then on Hitman Blood Money, I wanted to embrace both the orchestral side and the electronic side. And so that has, like, the, in my head, like the ultimate version of my Hitman music, because I am able to do electronic music and mix that with the orchestra. It's not just some orchestra tracks here and some electronic tracks there. I wanted those two music styles to be mixed together, so that when you hear the choir chanting, there's this crazy low key dance beat underneath, you know, like really doing things that was new, you know.
Oh yeah, I grew up big style on a lot of the same electronic music influences, I think, skipping into your work, so I was really, really loving hearing that stuff. That opening track, Apocalypse, is absolutely incredible. I did particularly want to ask about the use of percussion in it, actually, and it sounded like there was a lot of real percussion happening in that.
Yeah, that's some, but most of it is actually electronic percussion manipulated with samples. It's a very strange sound, that percussion sound, and it's not, you know, I don't know. It was kind of a product of it, its environment, and a product of the time, and I ended up working so hard on that percussion that at the end it didn't feel right to go and replace it with live, with like an all live percussion thing, because I just really liked how you know, badass and evil it sounded, and so I didn't want to lose that.
Oh, absolutely. I absolutely love that main track, and I don't know how much I might be imagining this just because I'm British myself. But moving briefly into a track like Vegas, also from the same game, whether I was hearing some like influences from old British spy movies in there.
No, that was not my perspective. But I see what you're saying. I mean, I definitely see what you're saying. The inspiration there came more from lounge music. That was what I was listening to a lot at the time.
Yeah, that, I mean, the spy theme thing is like a little side note I'd made. I mean, the main thing in that for me was the drums.
Right.
And how you'd captured that real showbiz sound through the brightness of the drums.
Right. I mean, I do love John Barry, you know. I mean, he's made some fantastic James Bond music, you know. So there could be a little bit of that in there. But my point of view was more on the whole lounge scene culture that was happening at that time. And I mean, it makes complete sense, like, right after all the raving and all the dance music and all the raves, and the rave influence in my music is kind of like, okay, you know, when you're done with the rave, there's chill out music, right? And and that became lounge music, you know. That kind of became a really cool, you know, music influence for me. All these great, you know, lounge album collections that kept coming out on CD, and that's really what I was listening to big time at the time. And I remember, you know, there was an opportunity here to do something along those lines, and I absolutely took, you know.
Well, yes, because we have spoken about a lot of the, like, the really big and epic main themes, but as a video game, there does have to be a lot of space and a lot of ambience within the music as well. And one thing I particularly wanted to talk with you about as well, because I was interested in how this might have developed throughout the series, is the use of dynamic music. Because I know this was something that you used a lot in Assassin's Creed, which we're going to talk about in the future, I hope. But like different layers of music, different speeds of music, and the transitions between the two. I wonder if you could talk about applying that to the Hitman series.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I mean, there's not a lot of dynamic music in the Hitman series. There were some in Hitman 1 because we were using direct music, so we could basically change the music on the fly completely. It's like WISE these days, the music program that, or FMOD. Those are the two most used music implementation programs. But yeah, it was more on direct. Funny enough, it's more on Hitman 1 that we really had that going. The perspective on the three other Hitman games was much more on getting the best possible music quality. And I feel that you have to be really... I mean, first of all, WISE wasn't available and these systems weren't available, so it had to be hard-coded into the game. It was like a lot of work. But more so, we were focused so much on the actual music and having the music shine. And when you start taking layers out of music... which is a popular thing to do in games, you have to be really careful, because sometimes you're listening to something which is like half a track and you're like, but where's all the other stuff? And it's like, no, you're not, this moment is not intense enough for you to hear the other stuff, you know. And then you'd have to you know, you have to overcompensate for that kind of problem. So you would, like, you know, perhaps put too many things in a track so that you can pull things down without it sounding half empty. But there is a lot of problems when you start doing these interactive music things, and you really have to know what you're doing. You can't just deliver a track and say, here are all the layers, here are all the stems, and then, you know, the game starts pulling these layers up and down. Well, not, you know, starts removing layers, and then maybe it'll play all the layers when things are at their full intensity. Because if you're running around playing the game and then, let's say, 75% of the time you are not in full intensity, then you're missing part of the music track. And I think it ends up getting really boring and really generic, and all the, you know, you're missing something in the music. So, you know, there's a lot of work you have to think about there when doing these kind of dynamic systems. And it's not always what's best for the music, you know. I like to listen to the ultimate music track, and there it is in all its glory. But you know, when you start removing, you know, some of the layers, it's like, wait, what's missing, right? You can hear something's missing. So yeah, this is a really complicated thing you have to think about when doing these things, if you don't want to end up somewhere where the music tends to start getting more boring.
Right, that's interesting, because I've always been a big champion of dynamic music, but I've never really thought about that before. And I think that's true, actually, that when it isn't implemented with a lot of love and care, that it can make the music a little bit too conspicuous. And I know one thing you've talked about in other interviews that really resonated with me as a fan of game music is how it's sort of your role to enhance the feeling of the player.
Yeah, and I want to enhance it in the best possible way with the best possible music, you know, and the music for me always takes center stage. Like, of course, it has to fit perfectly for everything. That goes without saying, but the music has to shine when it's there. And I'm not a huge fan of just like, I mean, I can tell you, this is one of the things I really had to learn when I transitioned into film scoring. That there are moments where the music is supposed to be on the score during like a conversation or something, and you're just supposed to sit back there and make something that's not impressive, that doesn't catch your eye or your ear. It's just supposed to sit there and you're not supposed to notice it. And that was really hard for me to learn as a game composer, because I'm always trying to set the maximum mood at all times. Now, of course, if I'm scoring a cutscene in a video game, all those film tricks apply, but I'm talking about the music running in the game. I always want the music to be something that makes you feel the maximum amount of what you're supposed to feel. So if this is a suspenseful moment, I want you to really feel that suspense. I don't want it to be like a light feeling of suspense, unless that's what's called for. But what I mean is, I want to go for it, you know. I want to hit those emotions as precisely and as possible and as strongly as possible. And like, you know, for film, you have to learn where is the music supposed to shine and where is it supposed to not even be noticed. And so yeah, that goes to what we were talking about, that and it also goes to what we were talking about, the layers, that music can quickly become underscore. And for video games, when you are exploring the world, you know, that's not I don't think that's the best solution. You know, that's not the best way.
So you also mentioned like how much you do enjoy having that final definitive track, which does lead me on to the vinyl releases that it was hopefully we were going to censor around a little bit in this conversation, because it is pretty exciting. And I'll make sure that there are links to, I believe both Hitman 1 and 2 are already released, right?
Yes, 1 and 2 are released, and there's going to be news on contracts and Blood Money soon.
Absolutely. So, like, it's really great to speak to you about this as well, because you are somebody who's got that history with the demo scene, and I feel has really been able to see video game music grow and expand in the various crazy ways that it has from those initial sound chip beginnings. So, kind of, how does it feel to have been, I guess, one of those kids who was a fan of Rob Hubbard, up to now seeing popular vinyl releases of video game music, and it is a fully embraced part of music culture rather than just being a strange little thing that geeky boys share between themselves on cassettes?
Yeah, it's pretty surreal, actually. It did, I don't think I could have anticipated how popular video game music has become, and how it feels like everyone wants to work on video game music almost. You know, it just, there was just this thing when I was starting out where video game music was like, nah, we don't want to work on that. You know, we're too good for that or something, you know? And all that just seems to have disappeared, you know? It's like everybody is interested in it, and there's no, you know, there's no denying that these days. And it's just, it's a wonderful thing, because I can, of course, look back and see, I've been there since the beginning and see how it all evolved. And this is one of those things that evolved as well. It's just really cool. I mean, especially the thing in opera houses have really blown my mind. I could never have imagined that either, that we can fill up opera houses with video game music, you know, and all these sold out performances that we've been, that I've been part of. And the level of craftsmanship put on at these shows, and the level of respect that the orchestra and the conductors and everybody in this opera house symphonic music institution, which is a bit more conservative, you would think, you know, with traditions going back and playing music that's hundreds of years old and playing them again and again, and just to see how excited this community is about video game music, it absolutely blows my mind.
Yeah, because this is why I asked about your experience with the orchestra and the choir as well, because I have heard from a couple of other composers that worked with orchestras fairly early on when that was coming into video game music, that there was a little bit of pushback from the players, and that the players and the orchestra themselves were almost a little bit like, video game, why are we doing that? So I'm really pleased to hear that you had a good experience with them.
Yeah, I mean, and it's like anything, you know, things evolve. You know, if you were to play some of my favorite music by Martin Galway, you know, on the Commodore 64, and you play that for an orchestra, I don't know if they would get it. I would get it. I think this is up there with anything else. You know, you put Mike Oldfield here, you put Martin Galway here, you know, I mean, these are not, you know, this is just music that I love. But these days, you know, music is so much more advanced, and it's so much easier for orchestras and choirs and this whole institution to understand what we're doing, because it sounds like music. It sounds like music that they understand, and video games is full of orchestral music, right? So it's just like ripe for orchestral performance.
And just since we're on this subject, and you mentioned Martin Galway and an orchestra and everything, have you heard of the 8-Bit Symphony?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah. I was so lucky to have gone to that. And for me, that was kind of proof of how incredible this composition is, despite it just being like three channels on a SID chip, how you can put something like Trap like Ben Daglish, and it is just... fully a John Williams type composition, as long as you get the orchestra to perform it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a symphony that they played all Rob Hubbard music, right?
Yep, Rob Hubbard. I think there was some Martin Galway in there a little bit as well, and Ben Daglish and the like. Yeah, but it was mostly Rob Hubbard, you're right.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, I do support that. I do believe I have to do... Yeah, I have the CD here. It's so wonderful, because I always knew when I heard that music, man, these melodies, like Spellbound, right, from Rob Hubbard. I mean, that music is magical. This is fabulous music. And in my head, okay, here it is, performed by an orchestra. Well, that's fine. That's great. But in my head, I always knew it was that good. You know, that's why I listened to it. I was always, you don't have to convince me. You know, if to me, that music was already as good as any orchestral music. You know, but it's great to hear it perform, don't get me wrong, but it's like, I already love that music. You know, I'm not going to love it more because it was performed by an orchestra. I am already a huge fan.
Absolutely. Same here. It just shows how much this stuff has evolved, and is maybe people are starting to take note of it, as because you said people can sometimes be a little snooty about this, or have been in the past. It's starting to be considered, in inverted quotes, real music, although it's people like me and you, it always was anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I understand, you know, Commodore 64 music is not something that, if you play it for someone who's never heard that music style before, is that quick to get into. You know, you mm-hmm. have to take some, you have to be open-minded to listen to that music, you know? I don't hear it like that, of course, you know.
But, you know, I live in a fairly small town in England, but I can go to our one record store, and there's a video game music section now, which has only really appeared like in the past 3 years or so. And I'm so glad to see it. And I actually, you know, now you mention it, I think I might have actually seen some of your stuff in there, but it looks like there'll be more to come. And one thing I definitely wanted to ask about with this was, whether you do have to go through a process of remastering it for vinyl, because I imagine you probably do.
Yeah, I mean, when the label does their own remaster for the actual vinyl release, because there are a few things that you have to keep in mind when it goes on vinyl. But there's also the other way of remastering, and that is actually taking the music and doing the master that I'm involved in before it goes to the label, and then they do their other quick master just for the vinyl. So there's several steps to get in, you know, that you go through, depending on if it's a brand new, you know, mix or not mix, but you know, a brand new master or not. So. But yeah, all the vinyl is great. I mean, I I think I have almost 20 vinyls out there, you know. It's really cool, and there's definitely more in the way. So wonderful to see the interest in vinyl, and I mean, a vinyl is so much cooler than a CD, but I still like CDs, I don't know. And I, of course, have vinyl, you know, as well that I listen to, but still, I like to crank up the CD as well. I'm not a big fan of all this compressed, you know, music that you find on the, you know, all this digital music, because it's you know, it's kind of like not the ultimate way of experiencing the music, I think, you know.
Agreed, and it's actually something that a lot of games companies and the developers, I feel like they're actually pushing more of now. Like, whereas they maybe didn't quite know what they had on their hands with certain composers, like yourself as well, maybe in the past, like you were just the composer. But I feel like now the developers are really getting behind when they've got a fantastic soundtrack and pushing it and getting it out there. Like, it's in the past 5 years or so, I've even noticed these soundtracks appearing on streaming services. Because I'm with you about the compression, but at least they're there now.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is true. I do think they've figured it out. And I mean, in my head, I was always like preaching this, because it's like, well, if we have a soundtrack that people love and they're listening to the soundtrack, they're going to be constantly reminded about the game that this soundtrack was written for. And, you know, you can play through like Assassin's Creed 2, 5, 10, 20, hardcore fans maybe, you know, can even more. But a CD, man, I can listen to, you know, Tubular Bells, I don't know, 100 times, and then I can listen to it another 100 times. You know, music, you can just listen to over and over and over and over. It has kind of more life that way. And for people to listen to the music, like I said, outside the game, they're just going to be reminded about the game. And it might even, I got to go back and play the game. Or when the sequel comes out, they never forgot about the game, because the music kept reminding them that about of that universe. And they kept thinking, oh, I hope, you know, a sequel comes along or something. So, I mean, in the perspective in the early days was like, oh, at least from my point of view, this is what I saw. Oh, well, you know, can we justify putting out the music on CD or vinyl or something like that? I mean, early days there was no vinyl, but can we put it out on CD? Can we make enough money? Da, da, da. But that's not really, you know, it's sure, you know, you have to put the music out. It generates money and all that. That's great. But when you look at a company, like some of these mega billion-dollar companies, you know, and you have a soundtrack, you shouldn't have a billion-dollar company to look at these soundtracks as how much money can we make on this. You should have them look at it, oh, this is a tool to promote our brand, and we can reach millions of people with this and promote our brand, instead of thinking about the finances of it. And so the early days, I thought it was more about the finances, but these days, game companies has realized that's like the wrong way to look at things. You know, it's about expanding your franchise and reach as many people as possible. And if you have a really good soundtrack, well, that's definitely one way to do it.
Absolutely. And I'm super pleased with how this conversation has gone. Thank you so much, Jesper. But in the last like 5 minutes or so, I might have to just be a bit self-indulgent and jump back to Batman, because I'm a huge Batman fan, and I actually was playing that game last night to get a flavour for it, and I'm really was taken back by that one, actually.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you like it. Yeah, that was a game I worked on with Clockwork Tortoise, and it was published by Sega, but I worked with Clockwork Tortoise directly. Sega had reached out to us, you know, us being Syrinx, after Subterranea came out, and had said that they were working on a game with a team that really likes the Subterranea soundtrack, if I would like to make music for their new Batman and Robin game. And of course, and especially when I found out that it was a totally insane action game inspired by like Gunspot Heroes, or do you remember those games?
Yeah, I think I know what you're getting at. Yeah, but yeah, it's on the tip of my tongue as well.
Yeah, you know, those crazy Japanese action games, just like Gunstar Heroes, remember?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Those games were insane, and when I saw this, I was like, oh my god, it's like a It's like an American Gunstar Heroes kind of thing. It's just like insane amount of action and just like get your heart rate completely through the roof, you know? It's like the modern day Doom, you know, where your heart is like, okay, I gotta not play this. But anyway, there's so much action that the music style needed to be something completely mental, and they were super on board with the whole dance music influences. And of course, I was it was a perfect fit for me, because this was the time I was writing music for Scorcher and doing my dance music for video games. And so when I came up with that idea of dance music, they were like, yes, this is so cool. And I just like was firing on all cylinders on that one, you know, just like. And it's also inspired by industrial music. We were listening to in Sirings a lot of Skinny Puppy and Ministry and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, there was a comment on the soundtrack that said this is what Trent Reznor would have done for a Sega Genesis soundtrack.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that. I mean, one of the things I was, I think, proudest of was able to achieve distortion on the FM chip, because that was really something I had, you know, that was a really difficult thing to achieve, because when you have distortion on the Mega Drive, it's usually for the bad, you know. People are like, we don't, you know, because of all those crappy 8-bit samples full of distortion and overdrive, but they're not, you know, that's not there because it's put there on purpose, it's there because limitations of the system. So adding all this distortion inside, you know, felt really kind of rebellious, you know, because that's what you're trying to avoid when you have this beautiful, clean 44 hertz FM music. That was one of my my joys too, was figuring out how to add distortion like on purpose, so people wouldn't think, oh, you know, listen to this crappy music or something, you know.
You see, this is what I liked about it, and I think it's what Rob Hubbard liked about the Genesis chip as well, is that it was kind of like the last time that you could experiment like that with chips before it did move into samples and just kind of freedom to use an orchestra, which is great. That's fantastic, and it's the way it should go, but it was a great time to hear that kind of experimentation.
Mm. Yeah.
I did want to say as well, quick, I do think Subterranean is fantastic, but in particular why Batman and Robin blew me away is because I sort of made that assumption of, I mean, I love the TV show, so I was like, oh, it's just going to be kind of like Danny Elfman kind of stuff. And then to get this like full-on 9-minute demo scene type thing was just like, oh man, this is so up my street.
I mean, that's what I listened to, obviously, as a kid, right? Like, you're listening to this Rob Hubbard music, like Knuckle Busters or something, and you just have that, like, 9-minute, 10-minute, whatever it is, title music. And you know, when they reach that 9-minute, I'm sure Rob was thinking, I can do anything I want here. And that's what it sounds like, right? That's what it sounds like he did. Because who's listening? And but we all were listening, right? And that's really what I brought to the Mega Drive. I brought a lot of these really long cues. That was a really important part of my process.
I actually think that's a really great thought to finish on, because I think that was the prevalent attitude in the late 80s and the early 90s, at least from developers or the public, was a who's listening kind of thing. But things have changed big time now, and a lot of people are listening, so many that we can get solid vinyl releases on the go. So, listeners, do be sure to check these out, because I will have links everywhere in the show notes.
Awesome.
And Jesper, it's been so good to talk to you, man.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me on. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to this new episode of The Sound Test. And please remember to subscribe or follow wherever you're listening for future VGM content. And I'm very much back on top of wanting to do as much as I can. I have even started doing sporadic live VGM radio shows, just like I used to, over at my Twitch. So if you're an old listener, or that sounds like your kind of thing anyway, come on over to twitch.tv/greenTeaRooms, and that's TEA, not the letter T, Green Tea Rooms, and I'd love to see you there, maybe once a month or so at the moment as I get started, for future VGM live shows and maybe the odd interview just like this. I hope you've enjoyed it. Also, make sure to check the links for all the information you'll need about these new Hitman vinyls and the ones that are already available. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and until the next one.